Very Bad Wizards is a podcast with a philosopher, my dad, and a psychologist, Dave Pizarro, having an informal discussion about issues in science and ethics. Please note that the discussion contains bad words that I'm not allowed to say, and knowing my dad, some very inappropriate jokes.
What you looking at, punk? I kick your heart out.
Get on, man.
The great end.
Welcome to Very Bad Wizards. I'm Tamler Summers from the University of Houston. Dave, starting August 1st, students are going to be allowed to carry guns onto campus. Do you still want to come down to Houston and give a talk?
I think that everybody should just be, it should be obligatory to carry a gun. That way you just never know. It could be like Wild West rules. I feel like it's going to be the kooks who are concealing the weapons. But if you just absolutely knew for sure that everybody in the classroom had a gun, including the professor, I feel like it would be a little safer.
Mutual assured destruction kind of thing.
Yeah. Exactly.
So this issue, which we just voted for it, I don't remember when it was on the ballot. It is an issue that has not brought out the best in the academic community, to put it mildly, to put it very mildly.
So this is okay, so this is now a new law across all University of Texas
public institutions, concealed carry on campus. I believe it's concealed carry. And now, and you know, there will be certain places where they can't have it, but they will be able to have it in the classroom.
I can just imagine just the University of Houston turning into like a Wild West show.
If you looked at my Facebook feed, you would think that that's about to happen. I'm serious. Like this, like all the sort of sanctimony, the self-righteousness, the hysteria, the hypocrisy, the cowardice, and just the irrationality of some of these people on my Facebook feed that they would never, ever tolerate from the right wing if it were coming on another issue. But for some reason, for this issue, everybody is allowed to engage in that kind of paranoia that if it was coming, say, on the issue of Islamic terrorism or something like that, they would vigorously condemn it and mock it for being irrational. And it's really unbelievable. So here, unfortunately, my university is at the forefront of this because of a...
Right, sorry, I was just going to say, it sounds like, for the record, you're fervently pro-guns.
No, I'm not pro-guns. If I was dictator, I would say, no, don't allow students to carry guns on campus. What I'm anti is the way people are responding to this. Sanctimonious, we should all resign because we can't do our jobs. I no longer feel safe in the workplace.
Right. And welcome to being a public school teacher in Los Angeles.
Our faculty senate, the University of Houston faculty senate, made the news, not in a good way, but with a PowerPoint slide on informing our university community about this new law and making some suggestions and just sort of clarifying what the law was. And there is this one slide that made all the rounds, like Slate, The Chronicle, and here's what this slide said. Okay, are you ready?
Yes.
So once the law goes into effect, it hasn't yet, but it starts August 1st, it says, you may want to, bullet point one, be careful discussing sensitive topics. Bullet point two, drop certain topics from your curriculum. Bullet point three, not, quote, go there if you sense anger.
That's the worst.
That's the worst one, I think. I'm not even sure if that's the worst one, because wait till the last one. Limit student access off hours. Not sure what that means. go to appointment only office hours.
Well, that's just a good idea.
And then, yeah, that's probably. And then the last bullet point is only meet, quote, that student, unquote, in controlled circumstances. What do they mean by that student?
And yeah, and what do they mean by controlled circumstances? is there a situation in which them carrying a concealed weapon will be more controllable for you? If it's
and who is that student?
Like that student
is it's definitely student. Not the student that's like brandishing guns in class and like threatening to kill you, because then you're not going to meet them in controlled circumstances. You're going to so no. You know what? I'm sure you're going to defend your liberal brethren. And I'm a liberal too, but like the academic left brethren and Sithren, what is it?
I don't know.
So go ahead. Do it.
No. I'm not going to defend. You're the liberal East Coast Boston Brahmin. I was just chuckling to myself because I picture Yosemite Sam, like just a bunch of Yosemite Sams in the classroom, just popping off their guns in the air. Like every time you say something they agree with.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, one of the ironies is that, like, I wish my students would engage with the material enough to the point where I was even remotely worried about them getting angry enough to shoot me in class. Like I would love for students. They are so focused right now on just, especially at this time in the semester, they're so focused on like, what do I have to do to get the grade I need for this? Like there's so much just means end reasoning right now. And
right.
I don't think that they'll think, okay, the best thing I could do right now is get angry and start shooting up the classroom. And I also just like just the idea that you were – I mean, obviously like the not go there if you sense anger is ridiculous, like, and obviously written by like a 65-year-old. But the idea that you would drop certain topics from your curriculum or be careful discussing sensitive subjects just seems – If there was even the hint of evidence that, you know, allowing guns on campus raises the risk of a shooting, say, when you're discussing abortion or what? Like,
right. Well, I mean, that's a good question. Is there any evidence that conceal and carry laws in public places increase gun violence?
Not at all.
And you're sure about that?
No.
I'm not sure,
but I'm pretty sure that there's not. And I also know that other campuses do allow it, and there's never been a shooting at those campuses, and there have been plenty of shootings. I mean, think about it just intuitively, right? The kind of person who's going to shoot somebody in a classroom, right, or a professor or other students in a classroom, are they the kind of person that wait until August 1st so the law goes into effect so that they can now, for the first time ever, bring guns on? Like, where I see this law being a problem, and this is why I would ban it, I don't feel unsafe by it at all, but I see this more a problem like if they're in dorms or something like that, and just one of those drunken fights that you sometimes get into in college, and now all of a sudden it's like swingers, you know, somebody pulls out a gun.
Right. Yeah.
Like, that's what I would worry about.
Well, that's my concern. And I have to say, you know, I agree that the risk is there, really. Like, somebody who's going to do a shooting is not the sort of person who's going to get a concealed carry permit. But I do wonder about myself in certain situations when I was younger having a gun just on me, right? And
why?
Whether that would have tempted me to.
What would you have done? I want to hear this.
I mean, I think that just the chances of me pulling out a gun and escalating an argument, just an argument, just getting angry, driving in California, for instance. I don't know that I would have had the self-control not to brandish. I don't know that I would shoot anybody, but I might brandish just thinking like, well, I'm going to pull out my gun and scare the shit out of this.
Pull up your shirt a little bit.
Like, yeah.
Right. Keep walking.
So, I mean, there's one way in which just if the base rate of guns out there increases, the chances that somebody are going to use it just necessarily increases.
Right.
Right. And so I can see why, for instance, you would get a bit nervous if you knew that everybody in your classroom had a gun on them or a knife or something like that. It's not a comfortable situation to know that people have a gun, actually wearing a gun underneath their summer dress or whatever.
that would be kind of hot.
I knew you were going to go. I was just trying not to be sexist and make it up. But that student, I wanted to be a girl in a summer dress. Like, yeah. Quote unquote, that student. A young woman, I should say. So I can see why people are upset. I agree with you that there's a bunch of hysteria surrounding guns in general. Right? Liberals just love to get outraged at guns.
Without knowing the data. Like, in the same way that they get mad at people, and rightly so, you know, who are scared about letting Syrian refugees in the country or something like that, even though there's no evidence that increases anybody's risk and that more toddlers have killed people than terrorists have killed Americans, right, since 9/11.
And more toddlers, more children die, like drowning in 1 inch of water in a backyard pool. Yeah. And I think that there is the problem of violence in this country, and gun violence in particular, but I would put money on that the vast majority of that is done with illegal guns. And I actually would venture to say that no, very, very few people I know who are really, really opposed to guns have ever even bothered to read. For instance, there's a guy named Gary Kleck who's, I think, the biggest proponent of this more guns, less crime. And whether he's right or not, he does a decent job at least of trying to mount a data-based argument. And it turns out the data is just really hard to get on this stuff because it's very hard, for instance, to know how many crimes are prevented. For instance, you know, a Korean grocer in South Central Los Angeles who had a shotgun behind the desk, behind the cash register. Who knows if that actually prevented people from holding up their swords?
Right.
I know in the riots, it certainly prevented, you know, there were a bunch of these great pictures of Korean grocers sitting on their roof with their shotguns across their lap. And there's were the stores that didn't get broken into. And I'm sure they were the kind of people who got the permits.
And that's so, when, like, I'm going to need a gun is when Eliza turns, like, 15.
I think Eliza just should get a gun at that point.
it'll just be a standoff, me and her. I'm going out with this guy. There's nothing you can do about it. Okay, make a move towards the door then.
She could just like graze your ear with a warning right. Shot. Because I guarantee you, by that time you'll be like getting the shakes if you hadn't had your drink of bourbon for the day.
Shoot the gun out of my hand and then yeah.
So, but you know, I all things being equal, I would rather students not be bringing guns into the classroom. But I tend to agree with you about the hysteria, and this is not the right way to approach it. The right way to approach it, if you want to mount an argument, is with good evidence based arguments, and I just don't see it happening.
And the idea that you would resign, of course, nobody's actually going to resign. It's sort of like Chris Rock said at the Oscars, like, it's only people without jobs that ask you not to quit your job.
Right. What would we do? What the hell would we do?
Exactly.
No, and I really hate the you know, all of a sudden sort of that PowerPoint. That PowerPoint was just
is so ridiculous.
Not go there. If you said it, drop certain topics from your curriculum. You know, we're all, I'm sorry to say this, but then you're always in danger if that's the case. There is nothing about a gun that makes you particularly less likely to get confronted.
Right.
By a student. And I agree with you that, like, it would almost be nice if somebody got so mad. You know, yeah. What if somebody was like, you know, internalism is bullshit, dude. And just like, get so angry that I'm an externalist for life. And I just pull out a gun. Peter Singer can go to hell and I'll go with him. I think that there is an interesting pedagogical sort of opportunity here to in philosophy or in psychology or in statistics or in sociology courses to actually start looking at the data, use this right. as a way to talk about it.
Well, here,
and I think that would actually diffuse some of the tension.
Now, we should say, if there is some sort of gun assault on campus, that person will have to be punished. There's a question of how that person should be punished, and that's the topic of our show today, which is a paper by Dan Kahan entitled, "Or What Do Alternative Sanctions Mean?"
Yeah, and I should say we've talked about Dan Kahan in previous podcasts. I believe that one of his co-authored articles was in my – we did a top five articles listicle episode, I don't know, way back when.
Yeah.
And he's done some great work on motivated reasoning. This is an older paper in a law review, but it's a great paper. It's it's great, and I think that
– yeah, so let's talk about it. And now that based on what you just said – well, I guess it's Skype, so even if you do brandish a gun at me
– I was just thinking, you know, in some of our arguments, it would have been just nice to have like at least a little device that would deliver a shock to to you in the middle of our arguments. So that you could be at least a little intimidated.
Which is the one that you would have like done whatever the long distance equivalent of?
Well, the argument that we didn't air fully,
where we had this huge argument and we couldn't play it and we just excerpted
I don't even remember what it was about.
Yeah. I think it was about trigger warnings.
Oh yeah,
it was our first foray into that, which should have been a sign that we should never discuss it again.
And we get, you know, the amount of people we get requesting that we talk about these sorts of things again is
a little distressing. It's not happening.
Yeah, we know. No, it's a literal trigger warning now. So we're gonna have to give like literal trigger warnings at the University of Houston.
Trigger warning.
I think that the most important, by the way, to wrap up this conversation, really, the most important thing is to train all of these people in target practice. If you have it coming, you know, maybe you deserve to be shot.
Right.
But what you don't deserve is to catch a stray. Right.
That's right. And if I'm going to be taken out, and I understand that I might, like, after all this, won't it be ironic when I just get shot in my classroom? But I want like a clean death. I don't want to be shot like in the gut or something like that.
Yeah, you don't want that ugly death. You know, I have a quick story to tell about this. When I was living in for a summer, I lived in East Los Angeles to be a counselor at a day camp for kids, you know, between 6 and 12 years old or something like that. And where I lived in East Los Angeles, some people might know, it was just a heavily populated gang territory. And the building that I lived in was on the corner of that separated four different gangs in East Los Angeles, and First Street and Fourth Street, for those who might know, and Cesar Chavez Boulevard, ironically. And this was the mid-90s, and the violence was from drive-bys was really, really bad. And the Mexican mafia, which is run out of prison and essentially controls the drug flow into Los Angeles, Southern California, and many other parts of the country, they were kind of tired of innocent people dying. So they basically said to all the Mexican gangs, if you have to kill somebody, you have to do it point blank, go up to them and actually take them out. No more drive-bys.
Ah, nice.
And there would be serious sanctions if anybody was caught doing the sort of coward drive and shoot.
Honorable. So if you're going to do it, you got to do it the honorable way.
Yeah. And that summer, one of the kids, I remember his cousin got shot that way. People just in broad daylight walked up to him, just popped one in his head and walked right away. And for what it's worth, you know, I think that I think it worked to prevent innocent people from getting killed. I mean, it makes you sort of have to get over some natural constraints of looking somebody directly in the face when you shoot at them.
Right.
It's, you know,
like the on-killing.
I don't know if anybody. Exactly.
Yeah. And I think, no, that does make a difference, right? It's like drive-bys are, you're just spraying. And it's not, but it's different than looking a person in the eye. You know what, like the new drive-by are drones. Drones are the new drive-by in the sense of, you know, taking...
We like to think that they have surgical precision, but yeah. We talked a little bit about this in our robot killing podcast.
Yeah.
But yeah, these drone operators, man, I feel bad for them.
I feel bad for the people who are like have drones circling over their...
I feel way more bad for them, too. I shouldn't say that. Just to be clear. Should we take a break and talk about the paper?
Yes, let's do that.
All right. All right. Back to Very Bad Wizards. Just like to take a moment to thank everybody who supported us. We really appreciate the PayPal donations. The t-shirt campaign ended, so thank you all who listened to last episode.
There was somebody that sort of made it happen? There were two people actually that made it happen.
Who tipped it? Mike Davey
and also Jennifer Rooney. So Mike Davey, he kind of told people, all right, we need two more. Jennifer Rooney then bought one and put out the word for another one. And within like, it was a very cool thing. Within like 10 minutes or something, it was done.
Right. It was great. So t-shirts are going out. I bought another hoodie. I think I've given out all my t-shirts.
And now we're pulling that design and we're going to work on another one.
Yeah. So thanks for everybody for supporting us, for emailing us, tweeting us, giving us iTunes reviews. Those always make us happy. If you want to continue to support us or start to support us, go to our verybadwizards.com/support. There's a PayPal link you can click to donate, and you can click on our Amazon link and make your purchases as you would normally, and we'll get a little bit of the cut. That actually went into getting Tamler a new microphone. Yep. So if he sounds extra sexy, that's why.
And a new interface.
This shit costs
some money.
It's expensive shit. You know, when we have voices that sound like we have tampons stuck in our throat, we have to do everything we can through technology to alter it. And email us at verybadwizards@gmail.com. You can tweet us at verybadwizards, at Tamler, at Pease, and leave us an iTunes review.
That helps.
I think that's it. Yeah. That helps. Wordle.
You probably don't listen to the 538 Elections podcast.
I don't.
But they always say that iTunes reviews help.
iTunes is surprisingly secretive with how exactly they rank podcasts, but it definitely helps my self-esteem.
I would support if the government wanted to like make them release their algorithm like they're trying to do with Apple to get into that guy's phone. Make iTunes.
You want to know how they rank podcasts on iTunes?
Exactly.
You just want to hack into it. You would learn how to program just for that, just to get back at those partially examined life guys.
We're set up a Patreon account, and when we do that, that will allow you to support us by donating a small amount, large amount, any amount per episode that we release, and we'll try to put in some extra goodies for people who subscribe to us in that way.
Yep, like genuine used t-shirts from Tamler.
We do love the people who email us or tweet us pictures of them in the...
Seriously, it makes my day every time.
It's not hard to make our day.
It really isn't difficult.
Like, uncomfortably.
most of our lives are just shit. Just most occasions. If I were in one of those happiness studies where they ping your phone and ask you to rate how happy you are, I just sort of fear. But like if you caught me right when somebody had uploaded a picture of their t-shirt, I'd just be off the charts.
Right.
I'd be as happy as people in like whatever Puerto Rico and Denmark or whatever.
And you're in Ithaca, right? So that like with me, if I go into a bit of a funk, there's no danger of me throwing myself off anything.
Or you can just go outside and like the sunny weather will like calm you down. You know?
If I ever get really suicidal, like I'll discuss a sensitive topic in my class.
That's right.
Or maybe I'll go there. Like I'll have just a regular office hours that's not by appointment. It's not worth
it. Really is. Those non-appointment office hours are constantly getting us killed as professors. It's really, I don't know what people are thinking. Seriously, avoid debates about internalism or about Gettier.
All right, let's get into this. This was a really good paper called What Do Alternative Sanctions Mean? By Dan Kahan, who's a law professor at Yale. So the paper starts out and it notes, and this was written in 96, but I'd say this is even more true today, that people are dissatisfied with our current system of criminal justice and the massive prison population, the just sort of prison explosion. It asks the question, like, given that we don't love this huge prison population, why aren't we more excited about alternative sanctions? Why is that so politically unacceptable to consider these other types of sanctions besides imprisonment, given that we all think the prison population is too big and our criminal justice system relies too much on it? So a lot of people will say it's because people are too vindictive, people are too retributive, people are always crying for blood. But he says, I don't think that's exactly correct. Rather, the reason we're resistant, politically resistant, to alternative sanctions is because of what those alternative sanctions express, what they mean. They don't express condemnation in a dramatic enough way. And then the paper, which is kind of a masterpiece of structure, right?
Yeah,
like in a way that some of our papers haven't been. This one just very systematically makes this argument. And it's in three parts. The first part defends a kind of expressive theory of punishment, a theory about what we're doing when we punish people. Then part two gives an account of what currently are our alternative sanctions express, what they mean. And then part three is how can we make these alternative sanctions express condemnation in the proper way so to make them more politically acceptable. It's really clear. I urge everybody, we'll post a link to it. I urge everybody to read it. It's really well done. It does, even though it's a fairly long paper, it doesn't take too long to read.
A lot of it is footnotes.
Yeah,
it's a law review paper.
So half, there's one page where there's literally like three lines of actual text.
Right. We got to write these some law review papers. They're great. You can submit to like every law review journal at the same time.
Yeah, no, they have, and it's all like first or second year grad students that are making the decisions.
Yeah,
it's bizarre.
It is really weird. But some of these law review papers are just great. So there's a nice combination of sort of a bit of analysis, like a bit of conceptual analysis, but not too much. Kahan very clearly says, well, look, this is as deep as I'm going to delve into what it means to have this expressive theory of punishment. And he delves, I think, deep enough. And I think that's maybe where I'd like to start talking. This is really a wonderful paper. And I had never heard of it.
Yeah, I work on this topic.
Right.
And it just was linked to on like some blog post. And so I suggested that we talk about it, and I'm glad we did.
And so I think the fundamental claim is that whatever actions we take in punishment, they have a meaning.
Right.
Right. And that meaning is, it doesn't merely boil down to retribution or deterrence. that it is actually saying something, and that this is an important part of our moral psychology. That is, when we punish, we're not just saying, let's keep this person away from society or let's get revenge. What we're saying is we're voicing moral condemnation, and we're voicing it publicly. We're, as a society, saying, I really, really disapprove of what this person did.
Right. We're condemning it, yeah. And we're affirming the values that our laws are there to enforce. We're affirming them by punishing the person.
Right. And I really like this aspect of the argument. So one of the things you could say, well, you're expressing your values by punishing. Well, what values do you express? He just grants that the values and the way in which we express those values are probably largely culturally determined.
Right.
Right. So it just so happens that in our society in modern day, imprisonment, like the removal of liberty, happens to be a fundamentally sort of accepted way of expressing moral condemnation. And there are other ways that we just don't like in our society, but that other societies might be okay with.
Right.
And we'll get into some of those later, but he draws an interesting distinction between the use of fines in America versus in other parts of Western Europe, where in America it's just like you're almost just paying a fee in order to commit a crime.
The thing. Right. It's like buying, you're like buying the crime, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. You're like, well, that's how I feel about parking tickets. I feel like I'm paying extra for the ability to park illegally.
So the idea of punishment being a language is really interesting. And he says the only way we can understand our practices is by conceiving of punishment in that way. It's a language of how we talk to the criminals, and it's also a language of how we talk to the rest of society in which the criminal committed.
I love that metaphor. It's a language.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, there's a couple of criticisms that he addresses right off the bat. And he's not the first person to defend an expressive theory.
Right.
There was Joel Feinberg, has Gene Hampton, Durkheim, Emile Durkheim. There's the criticism of if you think of punishment this way, you're going to justify, say, punishments of homosexuality, putting Oscar Wilde in jail as a way of expressing condemnation for homosexuality. Like, you could justify punishing Oscar Wilde for being gay, or punishing anybody for being gay.
And so basically any value that your society happens to hold, you could justify punishment on the basis of saying that you're expressing society's values. And we, of course, have changed our values quite a bit, and it seems antiquated. It would seem horrible if we had expressed some of those values by punishing.
This is the quote from the paper. In his famous rejoinder to Lord Devlin, who had used the expressive theory to criticize proposals to decriminalize homosexuality, H.L.A. Hart, he's a famous philosopher of law, assailed this justification for punishment as belonging to the prehistory of morality. The idea that we punish offenders against a moral code, not to prevent harm or suffering or even the repetition of the offense, but simply as a means of venting or emphatically expressing moral condemnation, is uncomfortably close to human sacrifice as an expression of religious worship. So how does he respond to that?
I mean, one of the things he says is, look, there's nothing in the expressivist position that says that you ought to punish these. If anything, there is that value that you are expressing, that one ought not punish people, is just as amenable to this kind of sanction.
Right. So that's the really interesting thing. So not only does he correctly point out that obviously the expressive theory doesn't entail that you express condemnation of things that we shouldn't condemn, right? But actually, the expressive theory explains what's wrong with a law like that, and what's wrong with punishing people for being gay, because that's exactly what you're doing. You're expressing moral condemnation as a society for something that society shouldn't condemn.
Right.
And he does this a lot. It's like he uses the expressive theory as a means of explaining why certain objections to expressive theory have force.
Yeah. And I think that I mean, it's just a good point that whether you're making an argument about retribution or about deterrence, or whether you're mounting an argument from this expressive point of view, it's fairly content free. I mean, it's a different theory of what punishment is serving, but it's not really saying what ought to be punished, right? In all cases, those will be derived from the values of society. There's really no escaping that. There's nothing about the expressivist view in and of itself that says, well, punish more this kind of crime or punish less.
So here's one objection I can imagine, say, from the utilitarian, which is they have something built in to their theory that would disallow a law like that, which is, you know, assuming homosexuality doesn't carry negative consequences, you wouldn't be allowed to punish somebody for engaging in homosexual behavior on the consequentialist view.
Right. Although, but as we've seen, it's a double-edged sword, right? I mean, so there are the problems with the consequentialist view that it might especially be used to harshly punish crimes that society doesn't view so seriously just because it would prevent harm.
Right.
Right. So there's certain kinds of harm. And this, it really ties nicely into the psychology of wrongdoing, right? There are certain kinds of harm that we can't quantify, but that society really just values, holds in a different regard. So the same physical harm that somebody gives to another person by beating them up is seen very differently by society if they're shouting the N-word and it's a white-on-black crime than if it's a scuffle over,
right,
you know, over $100 or something. And so you might say, well, in both cases, the harm to the victim is identical, like the punch is delivered and the pain suffered is all identical. But society has this value that we think it's particularly ugly to target someone because of their race.
Right. He uses the example of like a hate crime homicide versus a mother who kills the person that molested her daughter. And he says the reason why we would punish her a lot less is because we condemn her actions way less than we condemn the person who committed the hate crimes.
Right. And so not only is building it on some quantifiable way of punishment particularly difficult because it's hard to quantify suffering, for instance, even if you do quantify it, it sort of is equalizing things in a way that society, whether right or wrong, I guess, right, society just doesn't find too palpable. Right? We don't want equivalencies based on this common denominator of, say, suffering,
right,
or harm.
So here's a question, and this was an objection that he considers, and I think it's an interesting answer philosophically and psychologically. If all we're doing with punishing people is condemning what they did and reaffirming values to the contrary, then why do we have to punish them at all? Why not just express the combination, the condemnation, say that was really bad, do that publicly, and
right, like just do the little shame sign, you know, the one finger over the other,
right,
and just be like, I disapprove of your rape, and just leave it at that. So I think he has a couple of things to say about this. The first is the background that he already built into this, which is he denies that there needs to be a independent sort of analytic notion of expressing condemnation that is independent from deterrence and retribution. He says, look, I'm saying like it's conceptually a different thing, but it is completely wrapped in to our concerns with retribution and deterrence as well.
You can't understand retribution and deterrence without the expressivist view.
Exactly. But then his more specific rejoinder is, look, what you'd be doing by publicly denouncing is essentially saying like, we don't take it that seriously. Right. You're saying like, if you only punish a rapist by saying like, bad rapist, right? Shouldn't have done that. What you're by failing to impose any other sanction, you're essentially communicating in this language, you're communicating that it's not that serious.
Right. Words and actions have meaning. And if you just use words, that doesn't express the same meaning than if you punish. Joel Feinberg, in his original paper on this, had another interesting example. Like, let's say a pilot goes over enemy airspace that they're not supposed to go over. And yeah. if the country, the pilot's country, just expresses that they shouldn't have done that and that it was wrong, but doesn't punish them, the other country is going to think, oh, they're secretly condoning it. Whereas if they actually punish the pilot, that sends the message that they really believe that it was wrong. And this is just obviously true, right? So lip service is not enough in a lot of these cases. You have to show that you really mean the condemnation, and that's where some sort of sanction has to come in. But does it have to be imprisonment? Maybe not.
Right, right. And what I like about this is it shows nicely the contingency of the forms of expression are going to, you know, he's not in any way arguing that there couldn't be a society in which public denunciation wouldn't carry with it some serious weight. Right, you can even imagine a small community where public denunciation was enough.
Yeah,
It just turns out that in our society, for historical reasons and for just the reasons of you know the large scale society in which we are, in which there's just much less personal interaction with people as you would have in a small community, it's just not enough, and it's trivializing. It's really trivializing the seriousness with which you should take the crime. And it also does a nice job of explaining why we've landed sort of a society on something like imprisonment. Imprisonment, the removal of liberty, seems like a nice balance between the more trivial ways of punishing a crime, you know, public denunciation or even fines or something like that, that don't convey the seriousness of it. But it doesn't get you into the dangerous territory that we devalue as society, where you're employing forms of punishment that we might think of as cruel,
barbaric,
and we'll get to that about particularly like in unequal ways of punishing, right? The things that are communicating something more than just moral condemnation,
right,
but rather superiority.
Exactly, yeah. And we'll get to that in the. But I want to return to your point about how, in defending an expressive theory, he doesn't. So he thinks there are two ways to do it. One is to just show that it's a whole separate theory of punishment, claim that it's analytically independent. Because certainly one of the criticisms of it is that it either reduces to utilitarianism or it reduces like the consequentialist benefits of expressing condemnation, or it reduces to retributivism. And what he says is that like he's not going to argue that it doesn't have conceptual connection to those. He's going to argue that you can't understand either of those theories without referencing the expressive function of punishment. Retributivists always have a hard time explaining and justifying this whole idea of just desserts, giving criminals the punishment that they deserve. Like there's some sort of platonic matching of punishment and crime. The expressive view actually makes some sense of this idea of why a criminal should be punished in proportion to the severity of their crime, because that punishment is an expression of more serious condemnation of the offense that the criminal committed.
Right.
And like when you compare it to other defenses of retributivism that involve the original position or just some sort of like Hegelian magical annulment or balancing of the universe, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, I find this a really nice way of making sense of our intuitions about what it means to deserve something, because upon reflection, it does seem very hard to justify what we mean by proportionality. So he says on page 602, sort of what you just said, it is also possible to use the expressive view to inform desert. On this account, an individual deserves punishment when he engages in behavior that conveys disrespect for important values. The proper retributive punishment is the one that appropriately expresses condemnation and reaffirms the values that the wrongdoer denies. And that's why just boiling it down to the sensations involved in the suffering of the victim is not enough. We want to use punishment as a way of expressing these values. So we want to say you're an extra bad person if you do this, right? If you callously and cold-bloodedly kill someone for money, that's different than killing someone who is attacking your kid, for instance.
Right.
Right. It really, even though the both of them are killing, what we're using punishment for, it is that metric. That proportionality is based on the values that we as a society have about how a person ought to be. And what I really like about this view is that how a person ought to be part, which is the psychology, I think, of what we expect moral character to be. We really do take into account the kind of person that committed the crime or the kind of person that would be capable of committing the crime. So a grisly murder in cold blood does seem to us as the work of somebody who deserves a little bit extra in their punishment.
A little bit of extra condemnation. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So given that he's actually not a huge fan of imprisonment, certainly not the amount of imprisonment that is that we have emphasized in this country, he now considers three different kinds of alternative sanctions and then argues that the problem with them is that they don't express the right kind of condemnation. The language is off. It's not saying the thing. And that explains the political dissatisfaction with these forms of punishment. So the first that he considers and doesn't endorse any version of is corporate punishment.
Corporal
punishment. Yeah. That was maybe a Freudian slip. Corporate punishment.
I want to quickly before we get into these, I want to say we kind of glossed over the dissatisfaction with imprisonment, and I don't think we need to go into it too much. There are all kinds of reasons why people both are sort of dissatisfied, especially theorists of punishment. And there are all kinds of reasons to think that ought to be changed. Some of them just boil down to the expense that is involved in such massive imprisonment, and some of it is actually about the justice of the imprisonment itself. So there are all kinds. I mean, you can read the paper, but there are all kinds of reasons. I take it as just true that
current system isn't working, and he uses that effectively. You know, a lot of people. This is true with restorative justice. Like, they'll criticize restorative justice without understanding that, and even if those criticisms have some force, the alternative right now has to also be considered. There's no system that's going to be flaw-free. The idea is to come up with a system that has the most benefits and the least amount of flaws. That's really important, and that will come up a lot. All right, so let's talk about why not flogging and whipping sociologist just wrote a book called In Defense of Flogging. The same sociologist, I forget his name.
Was it an S&M book?
No. It was the guy who wrote this interesting book called Cop in the Hood about patrolling. He spent a year patrolling as a policeman the streets of Baltimore, and so he wrote that, and then a later book is called In Defense of Flogging, but I'm blanking on his name. But he gives an interesting analysis of why that's not going to work, in spite of the fact that it might be really good for deterrence, and it might be really good if you're like trying to fulfill retributivist goals. Like, those theories can't explain why we are against flogging, according to Kahan.
Right. We weren't always, right? So part of the understanding of why we are against corporal punishment now has to be a historical one. Right. There is you can imagine one of the really nice points that he makes is it really isn't that we're so concerned with the degree of harm that we're bringing to the people whom we're trying to. Right. So he says, you know, we're giving them plenty of physical harm by putting them in prison.
Much worse.
Right. We're opening them up to beatings and sexual assault and all those sorts of things that just happen. Just statistically, we just know that they happen. Like, the longer you're in prison, the more likely some of the things is going to happen. So it can't hang on just a simple aversion to causing somebody harm. and he points out that the it's not unconstitutional. It's not cruel and unusual.
Right.
No, at least nobody has argued that it's cruel and unusual. It's just that right now we're just, as society, we find this to be a particularly distasteful way of punishing. We punish our kid. I mean, the way I understood it is that's how we punish our kids. And when you punish your kid by...
You hit your kid a lot?
No, just a little bit. Only when I'm trying to express my moral values.
Yeah.
No, but certainly a lot of people still do. And, you know, one of the things that just comes out in that sort of punishment is that there is an inherent superiority,
right,
of parent to child. And there was very much so corporal punishment used in the practice of slavery. And there are all kinds of reasons that as society we are communicating something with that kind of physical punishment that we find to be something that ought not be communicated in institutional forms of punishment. And that is just inherent inequality. You're saying I am superior to you.
I'm your parent. And so, yeah, it expresses a kind of paternalism. Yeah. And an inegalitarianism, like a hierarchy. And then I think separate from that are, but also, I mean, related, but separate is just the ugly associations it has with slavery.
Yeah.
And this is why it has such power when it's on the screen even. But imagine just like a flogging of a black criminal. That's sending a bad message. You know, it's unintentionally expressing certain messages that we don't want to express.
In some ways, I like this paper because it's not trying to mount a defense of society's values. It's just taking it sort of as it comes. And I think this is a very nicely realistic view. It's like, look, you know, it could be that flogging is perfect for retributive reasons and for consequentialist reasons. It might actually fit the bill, but it just won't fly. And the way that society is right now, for whatever reason, our psychology and our historical circumstances, and he's fine with his contextual understanding of it. He's not making a claim that the ultimate society should ban flogging.
Right. Maybe in the ultimate society, they shouldn't. Like, because it is a very cost-effective way of expressing condemnation. It's just not for us.
Right. Exactly.
Maybe for Singapore, but not for us. Okay, so then the next two he considers are fines and community service.
Right. I love this discussion, especially of the community service, right?
Yeah.
It's easy to boil that one down to, you're punishing them by making them do things that we would normally consider like the act of people with good moral character.
Right.
Like,
virtuous.
Virtuous. I'm going to punish you by making you engage in virtuous acts. Talk about expressing the wrong thing.
Right.
Like,
we like to say virtue is its own reward, and so we now punish people for doing virtuous things.
Right.
Again, so. It might work. Like, for some people, it might actually be worse than or more of a deterrent than imprisonment or flogging.
It might even rehabilitate.
It might even rehabilitate. I mean, but it's just sending this message that community service is a kind of punishment. And also, he's like, there's these other things where, like, you know, whatever you make them do, that's also some person's actual job.
Yeah,
and so, like, you're now expressing, like, what you're doing is actually, like, what you do when you get up in the morning every day is actually, like, a punishment that also sends an inadvertently bad message.
Right. As a punishment, you're going to be a tenured professor at the University of Houston.
And have to, like, see your faculty senate put out ridiculous paranoid PowerPoint. Fines, we alluded to it earlier, but fines sends the message not that the thing is wrong, but that there's a cost to what you're doing. So it's sort of like the like polluting or something like that. You have to pay an extra tax for polluting or something like that. But you can't do that for certain crimes. Like, it's not just that you get to pay this large sum of money and then you can rape somebody or you can assault somebody, right? Just like there's a price for a fancy car, there's a price for committing a crime.
Right. And this is where who knows if Alan Fiske had written his, I don't remember where Alan Fiske first expressed sort of theory of, but this is a really nice, it's nicely consistent with with Alan Fiske's view of the different modes of relationships that we have in society. And what you're saying essentially is you're taking something that is generally viewed as sacred, that of the moral correction of our citizens, and you're bringing it into the market pricing.
Yeah, that's right? a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it would be like, you don't want somebody to like be able to take a loan out to cover their rape. Right. Okay. this is just not right. And I think that's one way of saying what Fiske's relationship modes are doing. They're expressing within the context of a certain relationship, you're expressing the values that you would hold in that relationship. And it just is the case that, say, if you and I are friends, we don't engage in this sort of market kinds of interactions where I don't, if you invite me to dinner at your house, I don't calculate the cost of the ingredients and time that you use to cook dinner for me and then give it back to you. But it would be nice for me to cook for you, right? Yeah, because you've never invited me.
I guess.
Yeah. And then there are all kinds of complications with fines about, you know, what it means to have an equivalent form of punishment for a poor person versus a rich person.
Right.
That are just sort of logistical problems.
But that you could make to work out.
You could overcome them.
Yeah, you could overcome them if you were only committed to a retributivist or a consequentialist understanding. So,
right. But as he argues, the problem is fundamentally that it's expressing something that we don't want to express.
All right, let's take a quick break, and then we'll talk about Kahan's ideas about how to make some of these alternative sanctions send the right message and therefore make them more politically acceptable.
Right.
J'ai voulu me racheter.
Welcome back to Very Bad Wizards. We are talking about Dan Kahan's excellent paper, What Alternative Sanctions Mean. So far, we've been agreeing to the point where it's uncomfortable.
It's almost like a professional podcast, like where we're talking, like this is like lesson one of a MOOC.
Exactly.
It's almost unacceptable.
If like a MOOC by a professor who sounds like he has a tampon stuck down his throat. So let's see if we can find places to disagree. We're now up to the sort of final section of the paper, which is where he suggests, what can we do to make some of these alternative sanctions, like fining and community service, not corporal punishment, he thinks that's just not going to work, but what can we do to make these other things express the proper condemnation and therefore be punishments that people will find to be acceptable?
Right. And so I really like up until now what he's built up until now, and he's built sort of this case for widening, like I like to think of it as a sort of widening the spectrum of available punishments, right? Saying like we're just, all our eggs are in this one basket, and it's understandable, this is why it happens, but it's really become a problem. So can we just go back and see what other kinds of punishments might meet our desire for retribution, deterrence, as well as to express properly the values that we hold in society? And that's where what brings us to this section on shame. And I suspect maybe here is where we might have different opinions as to whether or not.
So the big, yeah, that's the big solution is to take some of these alternative sanctions, but add elements of shame and stigma to them. And if you do that, if you stigmatize people while they're doing community service or while they're paying fines or do community service in kind of creative public ways that shame them and that express the proper message, then we might be able to do these fines or these community service sanctions or some combination of prison and all of those and have people accept that as sending the right message to society and to the criminal. So shame, that's the big one. Shame.
Right.
And I think the reason it's the big one is because shaming has a long history in our human evolution as a way of motivating proper behavior and punishing people when they violate a community's norms. And so we're psychologically very attuned to shame, both when we are the shamers and when we are the shamees. You know, in terms of deterrence, it's a, you know, we'll do a lot to avoid being shamed. And in terms of, you know, just desserts, if that's the way you're thinking about it, shaming is you are suffering when you are shamed by your community. And
you're you're suffering specifically because you have some internalized notion of the infraction that you've committed. That
right.
Shame requires everybody to understand that an infraction has occurred.
Right.
You just wouldn't feel it if you didn't have some notion about the norm that you had violated.
And the reason, and yeah, exactly. So shame is specifically psychologically in our moral psychology tied to the idea of norm violation, which makes it a perfect choice in some ways for expressing condemnation of violating a norm. Right. So how do you do this, though? That's the issue. How can you attach shame to some of these alternative sanctions without sending the wrong message in just the same way that you were, say, for corporal punishment or, you know, like, right. So that's the question. And if you have to complain about this paper, maybe this is where some of the details on this are a little fuzzy.
You know, I want to point out that it's not that shame isn't already present in, for instance, imprisonment.
Right.
Right. Shame is part of being what it's like. The expected force of imprisonment in part is because it is shameful to be right. So I know people who've been in prison and like their reactions, they don't want anybody to know. Right. They'd rather actually not tell people than have them visit. Is a great deal of shame associated
right,
with prison.
Shame for the family and yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But it is a particularly expensive and way of expressing shame. So there's some of this, maybe if you can attach shame to cheaper sanctions, then it would have the same power but without all of the downsides.
So some of the ways that he talks about that people have done it are, you know, you have drunk drivers have license plates that say they were drunk drivers. Or right. I remember I heard, I think it was a This American Life, about a judge who, when kids would shoplift, they would make them hold up a sign saying, "I am a shoplifter," in front of the store. And
right.
that was their punishment. It's funny. There are two types of objections to the kind of shaming, that kind of shaming practice that doesn't involve imprisonment. One is that it's too lenient. It's not going to work. They won't care. If you're a criminal, you're not right. going to feel like the whole point of why you did these things is because you don't observe these.
You're
norms.
Shameless, right?
Yeah, you're shameless. And then there's another one, which is it's too humiliating. It carries sort of unpleasant associations with like the Scarlet Letter, right?
Exactly.
Like, you know, wearing the A around. And just the fact that you have both those criticisms is sort of interesting. In some ways, they sort of work to mitigate each other, but I think so both of them are issues.
This is my problem with it,
yeah.
Right? And I should say there's a friend of mine, Jennifer Jackwitt, wrote a lovely book on shame that's more recent. And
Is it out?
Yeah. Her book is out. We'll put a link to it. And in fact, she's at least a sometimes listener. So maybe we can have her on to talk about reviewing sort of the recent psychological stuff on shame.
Just to clarify, Dan Kahan is not a friend, right? Somehow?
No, I don't know him. Wow. No, I don't.
Yeah.
I like to think of strangers as friends I just haven't met yet.
That's like The Simpsons.
Yeah.
You can always depend on the kindness of strangers.
So here's my problem with shame, is it's surprisingly hard to calibrate. I think that point that you just made is the one that I find to be fundamentally problematic with shame. It is unlike, say, sentencing guidelines that say for, when 3 days in prison or 25 to life or something like that. Shame depends so much on the psychology of the person being shamed and on the judge's notion of what would be the right level of shame that I am wary of it. For both of those reasons, I think both of those objections are good ones. Let me just say one thing to the first point, though.
Like 10 years imprisonment is on a superficial level, say, easy to calibrate.
Yeah.
But like people are going to respond to 10 years in prison very differently.
Yeah.
Like,
no,
I would probably respond to that very differently than some other people would respond to it.
Everybody's going to take these sanctions, in a sort of idiosyncratic fashion, they'll respond to them. But there is something about what it means to be separated from society for a year that I think is fundamentally just an easier way to understand what it is you're doing to a person, right? Removing liberty is in some ways independent of the psychology of the agent, right? You are telling them you cannot have the right to go out and, go wherever you want for an entire year, and then whatever also sanctions come along with imprisonment after the imprisonment. Some cases you can't vote for a while or whatever. Very hard to get a job if you're convicted of a felony. I will grant that in some, like, I love this. There's some just ways in which you think, look, as a retributivist, this just fits the bill. So it points out page 633. In New York, a slumlord was sentenced to house arrest in one of his rat-infested tenements, where tenants greeted him with the banner, "Welcome, you reptile." If that's not justice, I don't know what is.
Exactly.
but whether or not the reason I like that is that whether or not he's shamed, he has to live in his own filth, like the filth that he was causing other people to live in.
No, so. If you can get it right, there's something about it that's very perfect, right? It's very perfect. Writing tip: you don't need to put "very" in front of the word "perfect." But I agree that it sounds great, but it can be very hard to get these things to actually fit, especially in a society like ours. Like in a small community, there could be really easy and effective ways to calibrate shame because people depend on each other, know each other. But in a larger one, this American Life, it was interesting. Like at first you were sort of cheering for the judge and thinking this is a great penalty, and then you realized that the kids didn't care. Like people were honking and like cheering her and slapping her five sometimes, and then it was just like, wait, is this actually working as a deterrent, as any kind of expression? Is this and I think that is the hard part. Right. Again, I think it's true of, for some people, prison is a rite of passage. It's like a point of pride that you serve some time. So, I mean, you're going to have this problem at some level.
But what you don't want is it to be only scratching the itch of the judge, right? That's what you don't want, right? You don't, because at least you know that if you put someone in prison for a year, you are in some way giving them consequences that their mental state cannot escape.
Well, here's where I think, so if you incorporate some elements of restorative justice, which he doesn't talk about in this essay really at all, although he mentions Braithwaite and his book Crime, Shame, and Reintegration, but if you involve the victim, that allows for first of all, an element of apology, which I think is a very important part of expressing, of like... not only condemnation from the outside, but like I condemn and apologize for my own actions and restitution. And this is important, and this is a big part of restorative justice, reintegration for the offender once they've made things right as much as possible into the community, which can address at least some of the worries, which is that it's too alienating or too stigmatizing. Like, this is a way of also making the person now come back within the community and hopefully a little more aware of what the norms are and of why violating the norms is wrong.
Right. So Khan does mention contrition in apology rituals. This is page 634.
Did you say Khan?
Contrition. Contrition rituals.
No. You said
Khan.
Oh, Khan. Yeah. Okay.
I like how you just hear Kant whenever I speak.
nightmares.
Yeah, in Maryland, for example, juvenile offenders must apologize on their hands and knees and are released from confinement only if they persuade their victims that their remorse is sincere. Other jurisdictions use community-based sanctions that include public apologies and appropriate reparations. So
take those acting classes, kid.
Yeah, that's what I fear, right? Which is that the standard, that of whether or not you appropriately convinced the victim or the family of the victim that you're sincere? It just reminds me of trying to get a kid to apologize and having them say, "Fine, I'm sorry," you know. And it's like,
sorry.
Yeah. And what you don't want is to reward the good actors.
But this is why it's not just apology, and I don't like that hands and knees. I think that's stupid. Like, you get them to apologize however they're going to apologize, but then they also have to like come to some sort of resolution as to how to make this right, which can involve imprisonment, it can involve restitution, it can involve fines, it can involve, I want you to like work for this shelter now where that takes care of people who have been harmed by people like you, whatever it is. You know, it's not just I believe that you're sorry. You have to do things to show that you're sorry. And, you know, look, there's going to be some cases where there's no way to make them sorry.
Yeah.
Like, so then you just do the best you can. Again, like, prison certainly doesn't make them sorry, like, that they violated. It makes them sorry for themselves, but not...
Sorry they got caught.
Yeah. Sorry they got caught. Yeah, exactly.
Here's a point I wanted to make about this. So I think that what one of the good positive claims here is that shaming could work. And it does work in some cases, like publishing the biggest tax evaders in the state, right, on public websites makes them more likely to pay their taxes. So I think really what we got to find is to tie in the psychology of shame for the kinds of crimes and the kinds of criminals that it's that is like, find those groups of people for whom shame is likely to work as a sanction, and use it for those kind of crimes. So somebody with good public standing, a businessman in a local community who's not paying their taxes, their business would be hurt, and they probably would be really, really averse to having their picture posted on a website. But for other kinds of crimes...
Their family, even if it's just their family. They might not care about their crime.
Exactly.
Their family.
Exactly.
That.
For other kinds of crimes, I think it borders on trivial to cruel and unusual. And I think that this is where the very point that Khan makes at the beginning, that we have to see what we as society value. Is it worth it to make a kid endure sort of the public degradation for something that they did, in some cases where it might be extremely damaging to them in a particularly critical time of their life? Or is it worth it to just have that as something for criminals who don't give a shit? No, I don't think so. But I take seriously the possibility that we could widen our sanctions to these shaming kinds of sanctions when we know that it will work.
So when we know that it will work and that it will send the proper kind of message we want to send.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we disagreed too much.
God damn it.
As much as we tried. Unfortunately, to our shame, we'll do our best to, I don't know, what can we fight about next time? Maybe,
I don't know.
We could try to pick a topic that we disagree
maybe
about.
We could just say we should shame Tom Brady. One of the things that we wish we could have gotten into is some concrete examples of how we might shame in our, for instance,
shame him for just having a trumped up charge and like a witch hunt Again, yeah, I mean, like, I guess that's actually a good point. Like, there was a like,
Twitter
a witch
shame.
Hunt.
We should Twitter shame him. So
he's so immune to.
He's too dreamy. He's too dreamy to feel Twitter shame.
He's too committed to winning another Super Bowl.
All right.
We could shame Peyton Manning though. A little HGH.
Oh man, come on.
Sent to his house. Oh no, it's for his wife.
He would have been a little person were it not for HGH. Just look at him.
All right. Join us next time for Very Bad Wizards.
Very bad wizard.